bobbig.
Guten Morgen, Berlin!
Moin.
Those of you who know me probably know me from my research on programming languages or my contributions to Haskell. Or maybe more recently from the development of a smart contract substrate for the Cardano blockchain. But I've always also been fascinated by writing applications for mobile devices, and in particular iPhones. And as you know, we had to do this in Objective-C in the beginning, and still, I mean, I was interested enough, I did Objective-C, but then nearly exactly 10 years ago, Chris Lettner at the Apple Developer Conference announced Swift, and I was like, what? And downloaded the language definition, Redwood, and thought, oh, okay, they actually knew what they were doing. So, I mean, programming language researchers, they're always very critical of the programming language. So I really was like trying to find the flaws, but I thought, okay, this is actually not bad. And now, we are 10 years later, on Apple platforms, Swift is the de facto standard. But outside that admittedly quite large community, people don't talk a lot about Swift. And that's strange, because it's actually a cross-platform language, runs in all major operating systems. It's all open source software based on LLVM. Also, the language development is completely open, the public community. It's no longer this Apple thing anymore. It's a multi-paradigm language, the kind of language is popular, kind of every 3 years there are three new ones. But in contrast to many of the competing languages, if you see it as a competition, it actually is really concerned about performance. And that, of course, has to do with its origin. On a mobile device, you have to be careful. You have a battery, it runs out of energy, you don't have that much memory, so you have to be a bit more careful. But most of all, it's really great language for functional programming. And that brings me to my first question. Who here would consider themselves a functional programmer? And you don't have to be afraid. This conference has an anti-discrimination policy. Okay. So that's good, because I have another question. What's actually functional programming? I mean, it's not that easy anymore. In the past, everything was simpler, right? That's what the politicians also tell us. And these programming languages, well, once upon a time, functional programming was about functions, and of course you had to add closures and higher order functions, and that was really the distinguishing feature. But now, even Java has this stuff. So it makes it a little hard to kind of. So yeah, let me tell you what I think. I think really, well, it's of course about functions, but it's really about a certain set of idioms, programming idioms, programming blocks, Lego blocks, which go together to make for safe programming style, about it's hopefully easier to reason informally, which together form this mystical functional programming. So what I want to do, I want to go through some of these idioms with you in Swift, and then we're going to deep dive into two of those. And I'll try to highlight what's special about Swift and how it's actually a very powerful functional program. But let's start with the basics, namely functions, because we do still need functions. Okay, so this is an array, let bound, so this is good. A let keyword already is good stuff, right? Now, it also got a type, which I didn't have to write down, so obviously we've got type inference, gets even better. Then, of course, we have collective operations, so here's map function, And for all those Haskell enthusiasts in the audience, I kind of have Haskell code for some of the stuff, so it's easier to understand what's going on here. So this is obviously a lambda x to x plus 1. And there are a lot of brackets, which is annoying. So if the last thing, argument to pass to a function, is a closure, you can leave the round stuff away. And this is called a trailing closure. These days in Swift can even be more than one, but this is too much. But we use this weird dot notation. We'll see later why. There's sectioning. So if we have a function and we only want to pass a few arguments, we can selectively replace some of them with dollar some number. And that gives us a function with, in this case, one argument. But it's quite convenient because we don't need this flip business from Haskell because we can do it any opposite. And we can just pass the function as such, and we can do this for more complicated stuff too. So this looks like, okay, well, this is kind of good notation, but otherwise looks like decent functional code. All right, so what about type? So I'll get into structures a little later. Now, like many languages for built-in stuff, there's the actual definition, and then there's special purpose syntax to make it more compact. So for arrays, we have that. And then the type of map is something like that. So obviously, there are generics, meaning parametric polymorphism for the connoisseurs in Swift. So this is a type variable we quantify over. And then we have a function from element to t. And you have to put the brackets here, even if it's only one argument. And then we get a new array of t's. OK, not too bad. A little different order, some weird brackets. Okay, so now actually it's more complicated because Swift is very, very particular about everything, also exceptions. And exceptions have to be in the type of a function. And a function that can throw exceptions has to have that in the type. So this function which I passed as an argument can throw an exception, which means the map itself can also throw an exception because it doesn't catch everything this element processing function might throw. So we have these re-throws. So if you like this throw, re-throw annotation, it's like a sort of monad, exception monad wrapped around the results of all the things where it's at the error. So okay, and this is very strict. So the compiler checks this. If you try to throw somewhere where it's not in the signature, you get an error message. Stricter than Haskell, I could say. So, second thing, we need functions, but we need data types. So, data types, we have products. Now, they are called structs. So, Swift likes to, actually in general, but in particular Swift, what they did a lot of rebranding. They took functional programming concepts, and then they gave them names which are less scary to normal programmers, whatever that is. So instead of a product, we call it a struct. Everybody can handle structs, but only some people can handle products. Again, in Haskell it's this. That's no surprise. Then, for sums, obviously it's enumerations. Now, every language has structs and enumerations, so why am I going, I'm talking about this? Because we can have arguments to cases which are called associated values in Swift. And that's just your normal product sum type, which is parametric in this case, or a type variable. So, okay, that looks reasonable. Now, this can also be recursive. So we can have our usual binary tree definition for our parametric binary tree. Where in the leaf, we have one of the elements. And in the nodes, we have two subtrees. And it's a recursive definition. But I did say Swift is resource conscious. So actually, Swift goes to a lot of effort to make sure all these things are represented in an unboxed manner, meaning no pointer to a heap structure, but really in the registers or on the stack, the actual binary data. Now, that makes recursion be problematic, which means you have to be explicit about it. So you have to say this particular enum, we actually want to have a pointer to this thing, because then we can use it for recursive. So we can have all the goodies, but we have to be a bit more explicit about it. All right, so we have function, higher order functions, we have algebraic data types. Let's look a little bit more at these data types. So if we want to use one of these structs, we have constructor, and we can bind it to the value to variable, and then we can define a function on it, length function. So you see one thing about Swift, inherited from Objective-C, is everything is kind of labeled arguments. There's ways to leave the label up, but usually you have these labels. And, well, this is just a length function, no surprise here. And then we can call that. But this is not what a self-respecting Swift programmer would write. What a self-respecting Swift programmer would write, they would put this thing into the struct definition as a kind of method on that struct. And because it doesn't need an argument anymore, because the only argument was self, or is now itself, we can make this into what's called a computed property. So a var, but it actually does a computation, doesn't have storage associated to it. Okay, this is what the Swift programmer would write, and then you call it with documentation. Why are we doing this? Because Swift app uses, like many of our inspired languages, app uses data structure definitions as namespaces. You have only one global namespace, more or less, which you don't want to pollute, so you put all these function definitions into data definitions in order to namespace them. Okay. So, now let's look at this vector. So this is a lag binding, so obviously if we try to override it, the compiler is unhappy. But there's also variables in Swift. So if you make it a var, compiler is happy again. Now, if we try to, even it's a var, and we try to just change one component, compiler unhappy again, because says lag here. So we have to make this into a var if this should work. So we have quite fine-grained granularity control. It's a bit like con stuff in Rust. So we'll come back to this. So as I said, I go over some of the main function programming idioms, and then we do deep dive. We will deep dive. Let's talk about types. So we had this option. Well, this is maybe. Obviously, they are generic, so parametric polymorphism, we talked about type inference, and there are no null types, like in every self-respecting function programming language, right? So if you want a null pointer, if you want a null pointer kind of thing, well, you have to use maybe, option. So this doesn't work. You have to put an option around it, then it works. Now, because this happens a lot, there is special syntax. Question mark is optional. And instead of none, we can call it nil. So that's nice. Now, even if we assign a sum, meaning just thing, to that optional string, we don't have to put the sum in because compiler infers that for us. Now, if we want to use such a type, well, we have to do pattern matching. Pattern matching is boring. It's like in every other function programming language. But this is also very verbose. So there's actually, for optionals, there's a shorthand notation with lag, which only goes into the body of the lag binding if this is actually not nil. And because inventing a new name here only to use it once is a bit silly, you can actually write it like this. And then it's quite common. All right, so no null pointers. That's good. That's very good. But also we'll get back to this, because there's more goodies to have in tight land. Now another thing where, and this is really actually something which is still evolving, where Swift is very light, particular about static checking, is concurrency. Because, well, I told you, you write iPhone apps with this thing, and to write anything on a mobile device without a lot of multi-threading, if you want a responsive user interface, totally, completely impossible. So you have to have a lot of programmers write a lot of concurrent code. It's usually a good way for disaster. So Swift tries to kind of control the disaster area. So it uses, I'm not only going to say a few things, I'm going to go into detail. It uses, I think, a Wade style of programming, but it's fully tracked by the touch header. So like with exceptions, if you want to use multi-threading in a function, you have to put it into the type signature. And that propagates through. So it's like, again, a concurrency monad, which is being tracked by the touch header. Which is good. And then, because Swift also has classes, we'll see classes at the moment, there is a concurrency equivalent for it, which is a form of actor abstraction, which is basically a way to guarantee single thread access to all the state captured in a class or actor. And then finally, on the type level, you can annotate types as safe for being sent, which means you can move them from one thread to another. And typically, anything that's mutable is not safe to send to another thread, because then you have race conditions, which we don't want. So there's a lot going on here, and this is still, as I said, under development. So at the moment, descendable stuff, for example, you can choose between you want to have strong conformance, then it's very picky, or less strong, then you can still do some things. But I think it's quite interesting also to watch for people interested in language design, what they're doing here. Okay, deep dive. Let's look in more detail at mutability. So we had this example earlier. So what I explained before is that using var versus let, we control mutability of individual fields or variable bindings. But there's more to this story, because there are two kinds of types in Swift. There are value types and reference types. And so far, we've only seen value types. So that's the struct, enum, algebraic data types of Swift. Now, the difference between those are, if you like, all handling of value types is by value, whereas all handling by reference types is by reference. Which means, if I've got a by value vector, and then I assign it to another variable, and I don't use let here, I only use variables, and then I mutate the second one, and I print the first one, it didn't change. So this is value semantics. Stuff gets copied. This is a value copying, not references, pointers being passed around. In contrast, if I have class, and I do the same thing, one vector, and I assign it, then the same happens what you would expect in, say, Java. And of course, the original thing did change by modifying the copy to the pointer, if you like. Now, interesting is, this holds in exactly the same way for functions. what I forget to point out, even if we let bind this here, we can still do the assignment down here, because we let bound the reference, not the stuff inside. We could use let here on the x, then I could do this. All right, so, but I said functions. So if you define a function, which is the function which zeroes out the x component, and I pass this class-based vector to it, then calling this function will change the original value. So this is exactly what you expect in a class-based language, right? If I do the same thing with this struct, it will not change. So now I get a language where I can do the kind of class-based reference parsing thing, but I can also choose not to do that. And the rule in Swift is, whenever you have to define a data type, try to do it with a struct. If you cannot do it with a struct, because A, you need a notion of stable identity, which requires some sort of pointer, or you actually need these semantics, then you use the class. But the default is to do the function. Now, this has some implications, because I said data type definitions are used as namespaces, and the functions operating on data types go into the structure definition. Now, this length function is harmless because it doesn't modify anything. Let's do a function which is still harmless because it's a pure function. So this is a method defined on vectors, which gets a second offset vector, and then it translates, it moves the first vector corresponding to what we passed as an argument. Now this returns a new vector, pure, fine, no problem. But if you want to define a function which actually, because they are bars, we should be able to change them, right? Actually, in place, updates x and y with the modified values, then I have to say that. I can do that. Just like I can choose to put here var instead of let. But I have to be explicit about it. I have to say this function is actually not pure. Okay, so now we have annotation of purity at function definitions. That's pretty hardcore. That's kind of smells like Haskell. Okay. So now when we use this, then, I mean, this is the only consequence out of all the things I said, but I want to make it very clear this intent. Sorry for people in the back, you can't see this, but I say what's on the slide. It's a bit low. So here I'm creating a vector and I let bind it. And on that vector I invoke this move method. And then the compiler gets very angry and says, cannot use mutating member on immutable value. Now you got it. Okay. All right. So very precise. Everything is tracked, and you have to be explicit about where you change things and where you can't. You can always choose to, but you have to be explicit about it. All right. So of course, if I use a var binding instead of let binding, compiler is happy with me using move. All right. Question? Yeah.
Yeah, it's so I don't do Swift at all.
That's okay. Like
quite similar to REST. I have a question about the fact that it seems you're using the same syntax to do a bind value and a bind reference passing. So is it not sometimes confusing when you're writing? Okay, of course the compiler returns you. I mean, we'll say value, but when you're reading code and writing code, is it not somehow confusing to not know whether or not you are manipulating a value by a structure by value or by reference?
Good point.
The fact that there is no.
I totally get what you mean. So the point is basically, given that mutability is controlled by how you define a data type, when you use it, you just see the name, you don't know how it's defined. Isn't it confusing sometimes? When can I modify something? When can't I modify something? This is certainly the case insofar as you have to get used to this style so that you already anticipate that this possible ambiguity is present. But it's, I would say, given this talk is about functional programming, very typical of the functional style. You try to encode this information in the type, and then the type is a guide for what can I do with the thing or can't I do with this thing. So Swift follows that tradition. If you don't like that tradition, you won't like Swift, because Swift really goes completely gone hollow on it.
Is there any sort of user study of the use of var versus let in Swift programs? Because I think being lazy, I would just do all structs with var and never bother about let.
So the vars, very often you use var in structs. But because you can't, that doesn't mean a function can modify it. You still have to. And people rarely use mutating. Mutating they actually only use when necessary. And they do use let. I'm not aware of actual study. It would be interesting. But in code, you do see lets too. So it's not like. And then it's very much what you would expect. Like the experienced programmers use this much more than the newbies who go like, I don't understand the difference. All right. So, there's more. Because compound values are typically structs. Now that's surprising. So string, dictionaries, arrays, and so on. They're structs, they're not classes. And you can even build your own compound value structs. And that has the implication that, okay, this is easy, and of course we have a subscript operator, but if it try to assign to it, compiler is unhappy because this is a lead-bound value. I can't just modify it. And if I pass this thing, well, if I define it as a bar, then I can modify it, of course. And if I pass it on as an argument, then any argument is implicitly lead-bound, so I can't change it in the first place. If I want to change it, I have to make a local copy to a variable, and if I then shuffle, kind of move the elements around, destructively update that local array, this won't change the original one. So this is exactly precisely what you want from a function language, but which is basically never provided by non-function languages. Yeah.
Is it full copy, or it's copy on write? Or
copy on write. So, if I want to change this array, well, I have to change it here. And the type of shuffle, of course, is annotated as mutating. So everybody knows, and the compiler knows, which things you can apply on a lead-bound variable and which ones are not. So, there's one more thing on this mutability story. So if I nest things, so I have a new struct with a property which is an array of these vectors and then make an array of these paths, then not surprisingly I can do this thing, right? But in Swift this is first class. So I can define a lambda type, I'm not using this variable, I'm using this type, then I'm using the same accessor path, and I get the value of type writable key path on a path projecting out an int. And it can move this around. And this basically boils down to what lenses provide in Haskell. So it's kind of a lens implementation as part of the language. And this is actually very useful for UI programs. All right.
So would that also do the return a new value with only one part mutated? Not mutated, but copy the entire structure with one change?
So if you have, there are two types of key paths, which are not writable, they are read-only, and then they are writable ones. Writable ones you can only apply to var things, to mutable things. And then it will in place update that one thing.
And if I don't want to update,
you do let, yeah. Then you copy it, and then you update the copy, and the original stays as it is. So you're not allowed to in place update any lead bound. Okay. So, types. So the other thing about types, we saw generics, everything, are protocols. Well, the simplest protocol is equatable, which has equality, inequality, and default for inequality, if equality is provided. Well, that's a type, in a funny syntax. Now, you can say Java has interfaces, Rust has traits, but protocols in Haskell are really type classes, not interfaces. They have things like deriving mechanism, automatically deriving some type classes, and witness inference, so if you apply a function, the equatable protocol on an array of things, and you have an array implementation, generic one, and int one, or string one, then it will automatically infer the combination, so deriving witness by the type checker. And it has, and that I love, associated types, so given that it's one of my contributions to Haskell, that we have got this in Swift too. What's an associated type, you may ask, if you haven't done that in Haskell or Rust. It's basically a type which you define in a type class. So this corresponding Haskell code, what this identifier protocol does is provides you identity to any type that conforms to identifiable, because you have to provide a value, lowercase id, of type capital ID. And the capital ID type is dependent on the type for which I provide identity. So it can be different ID types for different types for which I provide identity. And there's a protocol constraint on that type. It has to be hashable. And when I define my own struct and I want to make it identifiable, and that means I conform to this protocol in Swift speak, then I have provided a definition for this id. And here I use UUID. This is another in standard library type, uniform universal identifier. And the type inference mechanism then determines that this capital ID must be the UUID type. So in contrast to Haskell, I don't have to be explicit about instantiation of associated types, but it's inferred when possible. Otherwise, I have to edit it. So let's have a little bit more complicated associated type. If we define a sequence of values, type element, what operation do we want? Containment, filter, map, and so on. In different sequences, probably code will be very similar. So we want to write that code once and reuse it. So we make sequence a bit more general and say, okay, every sequence has to provide an iterator in the sense of Rust or C++ iterator, and a function to provide that. But the iterator type itself has to conform to protocol, the iterator protocol, which also has an associated type, the elements it provides, and this next function. Well, now we've got a problem. These two elements, they need to be the same. So we need an equality constraint on those associated types. And now we can use this iterator and provide default implementations for all these functions. And then for every type which we make conformant to sequence and just implement that function and the corresponding iterator, we get all these functions for free. So that's quite powerful. Now, a sequence is a bit boring because if you use it sequential, you use it multiple times, you might not get the same stuff. Think about the sequence of data from a socket, right, with the times, you get different things. So we want the collection, which is sub-protocol of sequence, but it also got an index type. And here we have a type, the index type is dependent on the collection type. And that allows us to have safe subscripts, where subscripting is all never going to fail. And so the rest of the signature for the protocol is the start-end index, a way to iterate through the indices, and a subscript operation. Subscript gives the overloading for the square bracket notation. And we see here the result is not question mark, because when I create the index with these functions, I can only create indices which won't fall when we index it structurally. So the overflow check is an index computation, not in indexing, in subscribing.
The syntax I didn't understand on the slide, the curly braces with get inside, what does that mean?
Ah, yeah, I forgot to mention that. So it means that that this is only read-only. If it's get and set, then it's mutable, then it's read and write. This is part of saying which things are mutable.
What does it mean to be read-only?
You can read through the subject, but you can't update through the subscript.
So start. Why is it a why not write let in that case then, I guess is the question.
Because this is function definition and let is for value.
But start index and end index have the same modifier.
Yeah, here it could be let, okay. But the language, this is random decision by the language community to use this get set, and there's something there's tradition involved.
Execution used.
So we get this whole hierarchy of things, which I'm not going to go through. And where also mutability is only, you can choose whether you're mutable or not. And is it worth it? Ah, this is, by the way, called protocol-oriented programming, which is very much like type class programming in Haskell. But is it worth it? It's very flexible, but it's not uncomplicated. I think it's worth it, because if you could look at Java abstract collection, and you take the add method, you have five stupid exceptions which may or may not happen, and it doesn't even tell you about it, except in the docs, which you're not going to read anyway. But in Swift, there's no exception, because all these things are statically excluded, and that's due to the types. Okay, I'm nearly running out of time, so I want to conclude by saying a little bit about the ecosystem. And I want to start with memory management, because there's price here. Swift cares about, I said that a few times now, right? And trying to make things small and fast and run on mobile devices, maybe embedded devices. So deallocation latency is important. Apple experimented with stop and coffee garbage collection. Two versions of SDKs had experimental version of it. They threw it out again. This was for Objective-C. Why? Because this was relatively early iPhones, and iPhones always had a very high resolution screen, but very little memory. If you had three background images in your memory at once, the app would crash because it runs out of memory. So what's super important, if you deallocate a pointer to an image, this thing has to go away right away, because you load another image and you can't have two in memory. And with stop and copy collector, you just get deallocation latency on finalization. The other one is stop the world pauses. That's not always relevant, but I like to suggest, now these slides will be online, then you can see this, but Miguel de Icaza is the guy who did GNOME, he did Mono, C# open source, and he's now doing Swift, moved away from C#. Why? Because of this, and he explained it in this talk. Godot is a open source replacement for Unity, the game engine, and they just found they couldn't make it work without problems in those games people were writing. I highly recommend this talk. So Swift uses reference counting, not stop and copy. And in the last two versions, it started to add support for ownership types, Rust style, which you don't have to use. This you have to use, but it's for embedded systems, it's useful. And there's a nice blog post, very recent, where they wrote some for little mini handheld, which has very constrained memory and processor, some kind of ported the Swift toolchain to this thing. And there's a standard example which comes with the thing, it's written C, which has like 904 bytes, and the Swift version, it's for Game of Light, comes in at 788 bytes. Now, I showed you what level of abstraction this language supports, and we're talking about under 1 kilobyte kind of running software. I mean, in Haskell, you don't even get the, I don't know what, entry into the runtime system for that many bytes. As I said, it's a cross-platform system based on LLVM toolchain, running on all the standard operating systems. It has package manager. It's quite nice. If you use Cabal, then this thing is going to make you smile. Very simple. Just packages as Git repositories. Package specifications written in Swift themselves. That's what you would do, like embedded language style. And it's not perfect, but it's great. Swift evolution is an open process. It's a little bit like the THC steering committee with people around discussing and so on. Everybody can contribute. It's not just an Apple thing. So if this made you kind of like, maybe it's not so bad, then head over to swift.org and give it a try. Thank you very much.
So we have a few minutes left for questions, so do you just want to pick up?
Yes, thanks for the talk, great. I had a question about the syntax that you use for establishing type equalities within a protocol constraint.
Yeah.
So instead of using the where clause, is there a reason that the protocol itself is not parameterizable there, like with brackets, like you would do with the annotations or with the annotations of protocol parameters? Like, why prefer that syntax?
Because it's about equality there. So actually, there are basically two types of constraints you put into protocols that subtype subprotocol constraints, and they're equality constraints. And with the subtyping constraints, usually you can choose. You can in the square brackets, you can just type colon, and then the protocol type you want to have the subtype constraint on. But you can also use the where notation. Both is fine. It's just up to personal preference.
Right.
But with equality constraints, usually you have to use the where syntax, because the subtyping, they are always asymmetric, right? And you can use them in a binding position, in the position where you introduce the new type on which you impose the subtype constraint. Whereas, because equality is symmetric, so you don't want it at the syntactically, it doesn't look nice to have it in the introduction position of one of the type variables. But I'm not saying it would be impossible, but again, language designers decided this looks funny.
Sorry, don't figure out. I guess if you didn't do that, then like what I find a little strange is that I don't know what are the types I'm constraining on the protocol that I am sub-protocoling from.
Yeah.
So then I sort of have to go to that protocol instead of enforcing, like, okay, you'll have two parameters. But I understand.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thinking. One more question.
You said the word type many times today, but I did not hear the word kind even once.
Yeah. Very clever. No, it's not higher kinded.
Okay.
That's the big omission. It's on the list, on the to-do list. For those people who maybe... some language like Haskell or like the hardcore functional language, they allow higher kind so that you can explicitly have mappings from types to types and characterization sets of types, and they are usually often called kinds. And for Haskell, it's very important in order to have classes over monads and things like that. There's actually a way, so in many cases where you use higher kinded protocols, you can instead use an associative type. And there are, like, the internet is full of discussions which style is better. So it's on the list of things which was always planned but never happened so far. So that's how it is.
What is ecosystem like beyond iOS? Like, if I want to write a server application, do I find?
Yeah. I went very quickly over that because I was conscious of time. But there is the Swift Server Working Group, which is very serious. I mean, this is not just a bunch of people that came together and do a little bit something. They are actually very serious. And I think, okay, well-funded. And so a lot of the let's say, basic library functionality, which initially was only available for iOS and macOS, is being rewritten, so it's portable. So this is the foundation framework. And so this is mostly done now. And so it runs exactly the same code runs on Linux as would run on iOS. And the server working group, they also have some web frameworks and all the corresponding networking libraries and all the things you would usually expect for server-side development, which are being developed and are already, I mean, it's not, this is still an effort which is maybe 5 years, 6 years old, so you don't have the variety that you get in Ruby or something like that, but I think it's already ready for production use. Yeah. And cross-compiling is very easy because it's all based on LLVM, and LLVM is very portable. The tooling, also the source code debugger and everything, is just you can use on the very
one. All right, I'm afraid we're out of time. Maybe you're We'll take questions later.
Yeah, I'm around for the rest of the conference, so if you want to know anything about Swift, please let me know. I put up the slides for the links, and otherwise you can also find me here if you want to ask anything after the conference.